Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. So first of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. So I'm very happy to introduce this evening's guest speaker, the talented author Francisco Goldman. Francisco's first novel, The Long Night of White Chickens, won the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction. He followed with The Ordinary Seaman and The Divine Husband, and then tried his hand in nonfiction releasing The Art of the Political Murder in 2007, which was awarded both the New York Times 100 Notable Books, as well as Washington Post 100 Best Books of the Year. Francisco has been the recipient also of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a fellow at the New York Public Library Center for Scholars and Writers. So tonight, Francisco's here to present his new novel, Say Her Name. And while fiction, it does stem from a very personal story close to his heart, so please let us give him our undivided attention. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming author Francisco Goldman.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank you especially to the Tattered Cover, one of the great independent bookstores in the United States, and I am especially grateful to them for the support they've given me on this book and on every book. I think I've been here in pretty much every book I've done, but they really have gotten behind this one in a big way, and I'm grateful, and my publisher's grateful, and it's just great to, it's amazing to see these stores. You know, so many parts of the country don't have independent stores like this anymore. It's just amazing. Anyway, I'm going to read from Say Her Name. As you know, this is as Beth just said, it's called a novel, but it's also very autobiographical. I'm going to read a chapter. This is about what do you need to know for this? My wife, Aura Estrada. As you find out in the very first page of the book, perished because of a body surfing accident in Mazunte on the Oaxacan coast of Mexico in the summer of 2007. She was a graduate. She's from Mexico City, but she was a grad student at Columbia University. She was there with every scholarship you could imagine, the Fulbright, the Mexican government scholarship, the departmental scholarship of Columbia. But if you've read this far in the book, you know that she doesn't really want to be an academic, that she burns, right, really, with all her heart to be a fiction writer, to be a writer. And eventually you see, you know, the book traces sort of the whole arc of her, too short life. But the last year of her life, she had a great triumph when she secretly, and she had to do it in secret because it would have put her Columbia scholarships at risk because they demand a full-time commitment. She secretly applied to the Hunter Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing. She'd never written in English in her life, but she started to for that program, and it's very competitive, but she got in. And so that last year was crazy, where she was doing her PhD stuff and teaching the classes you have to teach for a PhD and secretly studying under some of the best writers in the English language. Peter Carey, the great Australian writer. Colin McCann, of course, won the National Book Award. That gives you some... I think that's almost all you need to know for this part. Oh, when I refer to the UNAM, that's the great autonomous public university in Mexico City where I would have studied as an undergrad. I think that's all you need to know. And I have in this book, I, as I do in actual life, have a part-time job also teaching at a college. You know, and anyway, I always say this sometimes to the audiences before I start. You know, if, you know, obviously this tells a very sad story in many ways, but Auda was the funniest person I ever met in my life, and our whole life was about humor. And so don't be embarrassed to laugh at any point, you know, that you want to. Auda was stuck in a broken elevator in Butler Library. She phoned me on her cell when I was at Wadley. There were other people in the elevator with her, someone urgently ringing the emergency bell, spritzing panic through the phone. I told Auda to stay calm, that surely it would be fixed within minutes, and to call me back as soon as it was. When after 15 minutes or so I hadn't heard from her, I phoned and there was no answer. Class was about to start. We were discussing The Street of Crocodiles, the book she'd have with her at the beach that final day. I didn't turn my phone off. About midway through, I told the students I had to make a call and stepped out. I got her voicemail and left a message asking her to let me know that she was okay. I pictured horrifying scenarios, air running out, Auda gasping, claustrophobic hysteria. Class was a disaster. When it was over and she still didn't answer, I phoned the Columbia switchboard, was transferred and put on hold until finally someone at campus security told me there'd been no report of a stuck elevator at Butler Library that day. It was as if the elevator had vanished with Auda and the others inside, and no one had noticed. Within seconds of her call to me, it turned out, the elevator glitch had fixed itself. The door had slid open, and Auda had proceeded directly into the reading room, where she was required to turn off her cell phone. And there she'd stayed studying for several hours, until finally she checked her emails, saw my frantic messages, and remembered. Or that time we had to go to a cocktail party in Manhattan. Auda was at home, and I was a few subway stops closer to Manhattan, down in Dumbo, where I was subletting a friend's inexpensive writing studio for a few months. The plan was that she would take the F train to the York Street stop, find me waiting on the platform, and then we'd ride the next train into Manhattan. One train came, its doors opened, a few people got out, another pulled in several minutes later. The station, winter-trapped inside, was a grimy cement and iron deep freezer. The payphones were broken. My cell phone didn't work down there. Robotic rats on the tracks, eating electricity and iron filings. How could this be happening? We'd timed it. I'd phoned her and said, "All right, I'm ready to go to the station." And she'd said, "Give me 5 more minutes." And so I waited 5 more minutes. She's still trying on clothes, I thought, pulling dresses on and taking them off because they're too sexy or too ostentatiously fashionable, or because they show off her breasts too much or reveal her tattoo. She liked the way her most prized dresses, including some of the ones I'd bought for her, looked in the mirror. She just wouldn't wear them out of the apartment. 4 trains had passed. My fingers and feet stung from the cold. My nose was running. I climbed the long stairs out of the station to phone her from the street. I had to walk nearly a block before my phone regained its signal. Wind gusted off the East River, whirling litter like frozen bats. She didn't answer her cell or our telephone at home. I went back into the station, and as I descended the stairs, I heard coming from far below, like the crash of rough surf, the sound of a train entering or leaving the station. On the platform, looking into the tunnel, I saw the dwindling green lights and orange dot of a Manhattan-bound F train. What if she was on it? I waited another half hour, then climbed out to the street again. I phoned the apartment where the party was, but she wasn't there either. That deja vu sensation of loneliness, bafflement, and sadness of, is this really happening? Then, I didn't know what else to do. I redescended into the station. If I described all of this to a psychoanalyst as a nightmare I'd had, wouldn't it seem to be about separation and death? What had happened, it turned out, was that Auda had gotten on the train at Carroll Gardens and ridden it only one stop to Bergen Street and had waited for me there. She'd confused Bergen with York Street two stops farther on, or had spaced out when I'd told her the plan. Finally, she trudged back toward home, feeling as bewildered and sad as I was, and she stopped into Sweet Melissa for a hot chocolate. Arriving back from abroad to New York airports, we always had to join separate lines at U.S. Immigration, even after we were married, with Auda in the much slower line for foreign visitors. I'd always clear passport control well before she did, then wait by the wall in front of where foreigners came out. Sometimes guards would tell me that I couldn't stand there, and I'd retreat to the luggage carousel. But often they left me alone, my unease stirring as the minutes passed, and still Auda hadn't appeared. Finally, I'd see her step up to one of the booths, and I'd feel a new surge of nerves, because what if there was something wrong with her papers again, or the agent was in a bad mood, or just liked to harass Mexicans, and turned her away on the slightest pretext? We'd all heard stories like that. Someone at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico had told Auda over the telephone that even having a Fulbright scholarship was no guarantee anymore of a student visa. What if at any moment, here at the mouth of the gate, she was going to be pulled back and returned to Mexico without even being allowed to speak to me? I rarely got to spy on Auda from afar like that, watching as she obediently pressed her fingers down on the fingerprint scanner and answered questions, meeting the custom officer's eye, smiling or even laughing in response to some remark from him, or else remaining serious and composed. This always brought back memories of being a small boy watching my mother talking to a policeman who'd just given her a parking ticket, or to a bank teller, or to a butcher in Haymarket Square. My awareness of their awareness of my mother's delicate prettiness and foreignness, my own sense of an unbreachable apartness. Until finally I saw the shrug of the officer's shoulder as he stamped her passport, and within seconds Auda was walking into my embrace. Moments of temporary separation and absence and even loss that were like little rehearsals for what was coming. Not premonition, but actual visitations. Death coming through its portal, taking Auda away, putting her back, receding back into its hole. Death, a subway train going the wrong way that you can't get off of because it makes no stops. No stopping for hot chocolate and death. That week after our first Christmas and New Year's together in Mexico, we took a room for 5 nights in a boutique hotel on the beach at Tulum. The first 3 mornings, we wound up having to drive from Tulum to the passport office in Cancun and back again in the afternoon, almost 100 miles each way. Auda had realized before we left for the beach that since arriving in Mexico a few weeks before, she'd lost her passport. Tia Lupe express mailed out his birth certificate from Guanajuato to the FedEx office in Cancun. Mexican bureaucracy is notorious. Long lines stretching all the way back to the Aztec Empire. Multiple appointments to schedule at this teller window or that counter. Many official forms to buy at those tiny stationery stores always owned by nice old ladies. To fill in, have notarized, then buy and fill in again because at one window some bureaucrat found one stupid infinitesimal thing filled out incorrectly, then re-notarize, and so on. Auda was a veteran of Mexican bureaucracies, the UNAMs being among the worst. It was captivating to witness the unruffled manner with which she endured it all, her serene, polite, and even pleasant interactions with the clerks and secretaries, winning over even the most bristlingly petty or hostile ones. All this opened a window into her temperament, I thought. I loved waiting in those passport office lines with Auda, even though it was how we were spending our Tulum vacation instead of at the beach. That mostly two-lane highway that we spent much of that brief vacation driving on, beaches and cenotes and ruins hidden from view, was like any ordinary highway, despite the billboards announcing resorts and water parks with Mayan names and motifs. Our rental car had a CD player, and at a gasoline station, because I told her I didn't really know his music, I would have bought a CD of Jose Jose's greatest hits. That was the only music we listened to in the long drives between Tulum and Cancun. The same sad ballads her mother had listened to in the terrible tower, weeping over her abandonment. On the Tulum-bound drive, we kept seeing small hand-painted signs directing us to Subway, which must be the name of a Mayan town, I deduced, pronouncing it Subway. I even said, maybe it says Subwaj, and we're not getting a good look at the signs. But no, it was a Y, not a J. For some mysterious reason, someone was trying to lure travelers to Subway. But it turned out to be Quintana Roo's first Subway sandwich franchise, in a small shopping plaza off the highway by a golf club outside Tulum. Auda hardly ever again passed by a Subway anywhere in the world without remarking, there's your Pueblo Maya, mi amor, Subway. To reach the beach where our hotel was, we'd turn off the highway onto a long stretch of dirt road, the car hitting the softer surface at nearly highway speed, bouncing and seeming to lift off and float through a brown cloud of churned-up dirt, as if riding one prolonged note of Jose Jose's sonorous voice, and that sense of dislocation again, of being propelled through a portal from an in-between world back into the beach town of Tulum. In the end, a bureaucrat at a window finally told Aura she could get her passport only in the state of her permanent residence. Why wasn't she told that on the first day? There is no answer to that question. Aura beside me in bed. What would happen to you, mi amor, if I ever left you? I would die, mi amor, you know that. You would. I know you would die, wouldn't you? I really would. And she laughed with a kind of childish delight and said, or if something happened to me, if it was me. No, Aura, no, stop. If it was me who died, then I would die too. I would. Aura, don't even say that. You would die, wouldn't you? Ay, mi amor, sadly shaking her head. You are so lucky, Francisco, she would say. You are the luckiest man on earth to have a young, intelligent, talented wife who loves you the way I do. Do you know how lucky you are? I know, mi amor. I'm the luckiest guy alive. You are, Francisco. You really are. I am, I know. And if you're going to be a father at your age, you're going to have to keep yourself in top shape. Babies weigh a lot, you know, and you have to carry them everywhere. That's why I go to the gym so much. I'm getting ready. And you have to pay attention all the time to what's going on around us when we walk in the street. If neither of us is good at paying attention, then I'm not having a baby with you. I know, mi amor. I'll pay attention for both of us, I promise. Every day a ghostly ruin. Every day the ruin of the day that was supposed to have been. Every second on the clock clicking forward. Anything I do or see or think. All of it made of ashes and charred shards, the ruins of the future. The life we were going to live. The child we were going to have. The years we were going to spend together. It was as if that life had already occurred millennia ago, in a lost secret city deep in the jungle, now crumbled into ruins, overgrown, its inhabitants extinguished, never discovered, their story never told by any human being outside it. A lost city with a lost name that only I remember, Subway. On the 96th Street subway platform, where, after a late lunch at the Columbia Ollie's, we were waiting for the express back to Brooklyn, Aura was saying, oh, you know, it's a text that's about the way texts generate discourses among texts, so no reason even to mention authors or authorial intention. Well, okay, I know that's true, but in her class that afternoon, taken up by a discussion of Borges's short story, Pierre Menard, Autor del Quijote, no one had laughed even once. But Frank, she exclaimed, didn't anybody realize that Borges was being funny when he wrote that story? The story's narrator, she recounted, is a mediocre critic who was indignant because his late friend Pierre Menard was left out of some catalog of important writers assembled by another critic. Okay, but does anyone else agree that Menard was so great? The Baroness and the Countess, they agree, said Aura, both of them friends of Menard and the critic. But they're just the Baroness and the Countess, she exclaimed. And the French Countess, she lives in Wichita or someplace like that now, married to a rich gringo. Don't you think that's a clue? a clue that Borges was also being silly and making fun of self-important bad writers. She mimicked a scolding professorial basso. No, Aura. Wrong, silly, que, bad writers. That's not how we read writers here, Aura. The red and pink tassels of yarn dangling like bunches of dwarf bananas, three on each side, from the Andean ear flaps of Aura's ridiculous pointy wool hat, and the spiky red tassel that crowned it, jiggled in unison with her bobbing cheeks and the peal of her laughter. Aura was having fun, too, her eyes gleaming. She'd go on like this, chattery, ebullient, all the way back to Brooklyn. Aura was discovering in those days that she wasn't like the other grad students, ideologically prohibited from considering the person and mischief of the author. She wasn't always so giddy to revel in or acknowledge those differences. She was often tormented with worry. I'm going to be expelled. They're going to take away my scholarship. They're going to send me to the gulag. Do you think Jim has a wooden leg? She asked, switching the subject to one that had lately preoccupied her. Valentina's husband, Jim, the super-rich investment banker, also quite a bit older than his wife. Hadn't I noticed? Wasn't that a wooden or prosthetic leg limp that Jim had? From the knee down, she said. His shone bone? His shun sheen? What do you call it? What if she asked Valentina if Jim had a wooden leg, and it turned out that he didn't? Would she be offended? Valentina was already insecure about how prematurely aged Jim looked, that she wouldn't let him come anywhere near Columbia. Well, even if his shin is made of cheese, I said, it won't be just some ordinary camembert. That guy makes a ton of money. Ay, mi amor, she said sweetly, que tonto eres. One night a few months later, coming out of a movie, we let ourselves lag behind Valentina and Jim on the sidewalk so that I could study his walk. Maybe he does, I thought. That summer they invited us to their country house and we went swimming. Arthritic stiffness was all it was. Waiting for the train to Brooklyn, listening, looking down into her face, so full of puppyish excitement and her own particular innocence. What was that innocence? What was Aura innocent of that I wasn't? Much past experience of failure and disappointment? Was love making me innocent again, wiping that history away? Aura was innocent of the power of her own gifts, and that, her innocent promise and humility, sometimes made her seem so fragile to me. At such moments, there in the subway platform, practically dizzy with love for her, I would sense how vulnerable she was, so caught up in her own excitement, not paying attention, so physically slight, to a shove from behind by some fiendish lunatic off his medication into the path of an oncoming train. This recurring fear of a crazed subway pusher was sometimes so strong that I would almost feel the urge to push her off the platform myself, as if the fiendish lunatic was me and I needed to get the inevitable over with, or as if I just couldn't endure so much love and happiness one more second. And simultaneously, in a silent burst of panic, I'd pull her to safety, away from the edge of the platform. My hands are on her waist or on her shoulders. I would gently pull her back into the mass of waiting passengers and put my own body between her and the tracks and give her a relieved kiss on the cheek. I never understood it, this awful urge to push her off the subway platform while simultaneously pulling her to safety, rescuing her from phantom fiends, but also from myself. Thank you. Well, I'd be very happy to take questions. Yes?
Francisco, can you tell us a little bit about the cover of the book and if there was a battle for you to get the cover that you wanted? And again, since we're being recorded tonight, can you keep the question?
Okay, great. Yeah, you asked me about the cover of the book. And if there was any battle to have that be the cover of the book. No, they surprised me. They came up with that cover. It's a photograph of Aura's wedding dress, her actual wedding dress, that was taken on the morning after the wedding by my editor's wife, because they were at the wedding, Rachel Cobb. She's a photographer, and you can see that if you look at it, you could see the tear in the dress because Auda had danced up a storm. We danced till dawn in the mud, partly in the mud. The wedding was in a village outside San Miguel Allende. And if you read the book, you see that the wedding dress is really iconic throughout the book, right? It's constantly referring to, among other ways it comes up, the way I, the narrator, have the dress hung over my mirror above a little altar we've made for her. And that dress hung on that over that mirror. It's a big, beautiful mirror that comes with the apartment we were renting. And it hung over that mirror until just a couple of months ago. And I think that that mirror, that was a very important image to me even during the writing of the book. I always it began to kind of symbolize to me in some ways the book itself. I thought of it, I don't know how many of you have seen the Shakespeare play Winter's Tale, where the dead queen Hermione gets turned into a statue. And then at the end, in the glorious last act, she comes alive. The statue comes alive. And I thought, you know, if I can just, writing it, I mean, I really, it's almost as if I really believed it, that if I could come up with the right words and fill that dress with the right words, I'd come home one day and she'd be standing there, like, in the dress. You know, like brought back to life, kind of, you know. And I think that was sort of really the guiding kind of you know, that was the muse of the book, really, kind of that notion. Yes, you had your hand up, and then you. Yes.
Why do you call it fiction? How much?
I call it a novel, which is not quite the same as fiction. Oh, why do I call it a fiction and not a memoir? Right. There are a lot of reasons for that. I always, you know, there's a lot of reasons, but I have three basic ones. I call them the fundamental reason, the poetic reason, and kind of the meta reason, right? The fundamental reason is that a lot of the book is about what happened after Auda's death, during the grief time. And I was writing that as I was living it, pretty much. And it involves a lot of people that we know really well. Things happened, crazy things happened, has happened in grief, especially extreme grief. A period of promiscuity, for example. You know, and I felt I had a sacred obligation to protect those people. And it's not a romantic clef. It's not like if I really read between the lines, I can figure out who this is. I had to make up entirely fictional people to convey the experiences I'd had and protect completely the privacy of whatever experiences I might have had. And so, you know, I've worked as a journalist, right? When I wrote Article of Murder, I mean, my understanding of nonfiction is you can't make up anything, right? So that once that degree of fiction had come into it, I didn't feel comfortable calling it nonfiction, which is what memoir is, as far as I understand it. But from the start, when I began the book, this is sort of the second reason, you know, I didn't want to be limited. I didn't want to write this like a work of journalism. I wanted freedom. I wanted a writer's freedom to write it the way I wanted to write it. And so among things from the start, you know, the book kind of tracks the development of the novel Auda was working on, the last year of her life. And I always thought that my dream for the book was, in the end, it was going to sort of merge into her novel and become her novel. Right? As truthful as everything about us I was telling may have been, that was sort of what I imagined happening. And it kind of does. If you get to the end, you'll see there's a moment. That doesn't totally happen, but it still makes that gesture. And you'll see there's a moment when he's climbing the stairs at the end, where he suddenly merges for a moment into Auda's novel, and then sort of realizes that, you know, she's other, she's lost, her imagination is autonomous and mysterious. And he goes, who knows what you would have done? Who knows what you would have written? It would have been great, you know? And he has to sort of acknowledge that at that moment. So to me, that's like a DNA in the book that runs through it, right? This strain of this novel. And also, you know, to me, this book was a way of keeping out of with me, sort of. And so I wanted to play with her. Right, so I wasn't sitting there like a journalist or a biographer going, what exactly did she say at this moment? You know, there are a few scenes in there where I'm just making up conversations that are like conversations we would have had because I was like communing with her. You know, even though the factual arc of her life and our lives together is totally, of course, I wouldn't make up anything about that. I didn't, you know, it's, so that's kind of why, you know, and then there's even, when you get even a little more abstract, it's my sense that memory is fictionalizes anyway. You know, that's the thing I don't really like about you say, you know, these are my memories, so this is a memoir and everything is true. I don't feel comfortable with that. Memory is so slippery and it fictionalizes all the time anyway. I almost think novels are the true memoirs, you know, because they acknowledge that. Yes.
You know, when I read The Year of Magical Thinking by Kidding, and also the piece and then that was excerpted in The New Yorker about Joyce's Carol Oates, and then there was yours, it occurred to me that the really interesting thing about these stories for the reader is what they tell about the uniqueness of different marriages. And I was wondering if that was something that you had in the back of your mind when you wrote about Aura.
The question is that, you know, there's been a spate of recent grief books, Joan Didion's and Joyce Carol Oates, among others. And this is a really interesting observation that they all convey different kinds of marriages. And was that something I intended to do, convey our marriage? Well, of course, yeah. I mean, I didn't think of it as like this is the main purpose. But I felt, you know, a sacred obligation. I mean, this is really why I wrote the book, to before memory came along and began to do its awful eroding thing, to get down who we were together, who she was, you know, and every, you know, the arc of her life story, but really what our marriage was, you know, and that was so important to me, you know, brief as it was. It's the most important years of my life. We were together 4 years. And 4 years is not a lot, but it's not a little either, you know. Of course, that was to me. I know that. I mean, obviously, I felt that they were certainly the happiest years of my life, and I certainly saw how that marriage changed both of us profoundly. You know.
What seemed great to me about it, though, is that you didn't really sentimentalize the marriage. When you're
retired, you
feel the sort of older husband.
Dragging himself
up to keep up with this.
Yeah, well, nobody would have an easy time keeping up with her at any age, but, you know, we were, she definitely kept me young, you know. But thank you for that observation. Yes?
Are there enough of all his writings left where conceivably something could be published or put together?
The question is there enough of all his writings left so they could be published? And the good news is it has been published. The day of Aura's funeral, in my insanity, you know, I made three promises to her. I wrote them down on a little piece of paper, thinking I was going to be able to put it in the coffin, but I couldn't because it had a plexiglass window over it. And I said, among other things in that note, sort of too personal, but I did say, you know, I'm going to get a writing of your books published. I'm going to start a prize in your name. And I'm going to leave a book that tells who you... I'm going to write my own book that tells who you were and who we were. And I've done all three. You know, it's the book is beautiful. It was published by a great press in Mexico called Almadía. It's called Mis Días in Shanghai. And I went, Aura was just so funny. She was so gifted. And I swear, seems to me like she used to start three short stories every day. And then she'd like go a paragraph or two and just stop. You know, when you go into her computer, you just find all these amazing, and she had the funniest way of saving things. And you know, she finished about 12, which are the heart of the book. And there's just this beautiful mosaic of fragments and essays, and some of these have appeared in English. She had a wonderful story published in Zoetrope, and another story published in Boston Review, then republished in Harper's. And the Harper's editor wrote to me and said, please translate more. This is the kind of young talent we're always looking for. She wrote mostly in Spanish, but she wrote in English too. You know, we had to translate some texts into English. She was a master at Spanish, just almost, really unique. And her English, of course, she didn't have the same mastery of it, but it was also pretty, beautiful and evocative. You know. Yes?
I have about 100 questions I'd like to ask you.
It's
none
nice.
Of them make any sense.
Oh, that's okay.
So I won't ask them. But I have to tell you that piece in The New Yorker was one of the loveliest things I've ever read.
Oh, thank you.
And that it broke my heart.
Thank you.
And thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet. Thank you. She's saying very kind things about the excerpt of the book that ran in the New Yorker. Thank you. Thank you.
I have to add that I'm a nurse, and I've worked with a lot of people in a lot of pain. And you wrote a true book.
Thank you. Yes, I hope it's a true book. It's it's like, I think what makes it a little different from some of the other grief books is I don't really try to analyze grief in this book. I just try to, it's not a self-help book. Nobody would ever say, go do what this guy did. You know, run around drunk, get hit by a car, try to seduce your ex-wife's friends. You know, I mean, a lot of appalling behavior. And I just wanted to get down what it's like. And I've noticed that. I think that's where it's useful to some people. On this tour, I've met people who have either had similar, sort of really traumatic sudden losses, or people who know people who have and wonder how to understand them. And I realize that it's people appreciate having the book there as a mirror. Like, yeah, this is what can happen. This is what it's like. You know, I'm not the only one. You know, so thank you. Yeah. Anything else? Well, thank you very much for coming, and I'm very happy to sign books.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.